Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did the 1945 U.S. invasion of Okinawa change life for residents there, and what are the repercussions today? Many Americans associate Okinawa with the U.S. military presence there, housing three-quarters of our presence in all of Japan and taking up fully one-fifth of Okinawa Island's landmass. Texas novelist Sarah Byrd lived there with her family during the Vietnam War, and as a kid didn't give much thought to the people or the troubled history of Okinawa. Since that time, though, she has done extensive research on the unique culture and profound suffering of Okinawans, brought on in part by conflicts they did not start. In her new book, she weaves together parallel narratives of an Okinawan teenager during 1945 and a present-day American military brat coming to terms with her own family's history and its relationship to what at first seems to be just another temporary home. Sarah Byrd's new novel is called Above the East China Sea. Sarah, welcome back to Think.
Well, thank you, Chris. I'm delighted to be here, and what a lovely synopsis.
Thank you. So your main characters here, Tomiko and Luz, are essentially walking the same places nearly 70 years apart. Both of them hurt by conflicts they had nothing to do with.
Exactly. That's correct. Both their narratives start at the same place, which is at the top of Suicide Cliffs, a place that I stood at when I was 18, and I wrote the same experience for them that I had, which is feeling a breeze from the East China Sea loft the hair off the back of my sweat-drenched neck. At that time, when I was 18, having no understanding whatsoever of the thousands of people who had jumped to their death from that cliff, mostly because of fear of what they believed or had been propagandized by the Japanese into believing would happen to them.
So interestingly, this is really not a spoiler here. Tomiko kills herself in the first pages of the book, but we get to know her throughout the rest of the novel based on sort of an interesting interpretation of her spirit in the afterlife.
Exactly. I knew from the very beginning that I did not want to do a ghost story yet. In order to do that, I had to make really clear to American readers a lot of the rules of Okinawan beliefs and how they believe deeply in the kami, which are their ancestors and the spirits and those who've gone before. And they believe that their lives are controlled by those who've gone before, and they're connected forever with them. And their ultimate goal in life is to be reunited with their family, which is Tamiko's ultimate goal for her and her child, which will not be able to happen if she dies a violent death.
And Luce, meanwhile, has lost her sister Cody, who she has essentially leaned on her whole life to be a source of stability when everything else is in constant transition.
That's exactly right. I have a very good friend, Mary Wirtz, who wrote sort of the Bible of military brats, and she's continued doing her research, and she shared a lot of it with me. And her basic premise is the military child's fundamental experience is an experience of loss. And I wanted to sort of update that because I had already written about my own experiences as a military brat growing up in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And I wanted to make readers understand that this continues today and, in fact, is heightened in a lot of ways because of so many single-parent families, a single mom or a single father with children in the military, and the demands of deployment and whatnot put tremendous stresses on the military family.
You challenge something, or I should say through Luce, you challenge something, which is this stereotype that those of us, particularly outside military culture, have, that military kids are instantly gifted at making friends wherever they go.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It is a myth that military kids are social geniuses, and that is true for a small percentage of maybe a larger percentage than you'd find in the general population, just because we get so much more practice than most kids. But as I have my character reflect in this book, most military kids, what they're not geniuses at, they're not geniuses at making friends. They're geniuses at leaving friends behind, because that's what they have to do. That's what their whole lives are predicated on.
And in situations where they're living and going to school with local kids, the local kids have learned not to invest any time in being friends with the military kids.
I know. I've had people tell me that later in life that, oh yeah, I knew military kids when I was growing up, and we knew not to bother making friends with them, but they'd be gone so soon. And that sort of explained something, a few things to me. But, you know, as I say, on the other hand, there are those who just glide into any school on earth, and they figured out by lunch who the popular group is, and they're sitting at their table, and, you know, they're, by evening, they're running for homecoming queen. But I certainly wasn't one of those.
So Luz finds a perfect target for her pain, and that is her mother.
Yeah. In growing up, she and her beloved sister, Cody, they were each other's emotional anchors in life. And her mom is a sergeant and she's a base security person. And she has to be tough. She has to be tougher than anyone around. And she brings that home. And she's also a military brat. She's the child of military brats. So she's definitely washed in that blood. And so growing up, Cody and her beloved sister Luz have this pact that they think all things military are creepy and weird, and they can't wait to escape. So it's the biggest shock of Luz's life when Cody secretly enlists and then goes off to Afghanistan.
When you talk about her mother being tough, I love the description where Luz says, "My mother's room smells like she does," and it's something like, you know, freshly pressed uniform, vanilla musk lotion, and gun oil.
That's all of that those limbic connections, sense of smell are so powerful for me. And I mean, I can still to this day smell Brasso, and suddenly I see my dad polishing his buckle and his, you know, things that he, what are, you know, his insignia.
Yeah. I found it so true to life that it never occurs to Luz, or at least it doesn't initially, to think about the pain that that their loss has caused to her mother, right? And it's that thing we all do as teenagers where we begin to criticize everything about the authority figures in our lives, and yet we still think that they ought to be omnipotent, right? We still expect them to have gotten everything right.
That's exactly right, and that's I'm glad you pick up on that, because it's sort of easy to criticize Luz and to forget that she's 17, and how aware were any of us at the age of 17? You know, we're just, well, I certainly wasn't. I mean, that's a big part of writing this book, that I was certainly as oblivious as Luz was. And I kind of, the way I think about it now is I was sort of an unmanned intelligence drone flying through my life, collecting experiences that I would only make sense of decades later. And that's part of the reason I sat down to write this book, is to understand, you know, what it meant to have stood at the top of that cliff.
Was there an epiphany for you when you realized that you had lived in Okinawa and really not understood anything about it?
Many. I would say many almost jaw-dropping epiphanies. The biggest one, which stuns me to this day, is that more people died during the 82 days of the invasion of Okinawa. More human life was lost than at Nagasaki and Hiroshima combined. You know, certainly not to diminish that tragedy at all, but why do we know everything about that event? And certainly I knew nothing about the extent of the loss on Okinawa, and very, very few Americans do. How grievous it was, and many military historians point to the invasion of Okinawa as the largest land, sea, air battle in the history, in military history. There are quibbles about that depending on how you calculate these things, but that certainly, it goes without saying, it was an immense, immense battle.
And a significant portion of those casualties were civilians.
Yes. As much as a third of the civilian population was lost during, either directly during the invasion or later, from starvation, malnutrition, disease, injuries suffered, and lots of suicides, many of them compulsory, ordered by the Japanese army.
Tell us a little bit about the history, the modern history of Okinawa, because I think some Americans today know that, you know, it's part of Japan, and though our Japanese bases, our bases in Japan are in Okinawa, and I don't know that a lot of people have a full appreciation for just how unique the culture of Okinawa is.
That's right. That's exactly right. For most of its history, Okinawa, the Ryukyu Islands, which Okinawa is the main island of, the Ryukyu Islands were an independent kingdom, very successful in trading from all the way down to Java up to Korea in the north. And they were a tribute state of China. So much of their culture is Chinese-based. Certainly the very distinct burial customs were Chinese, from the Chinese. And beginning in the 1600s, the Japanese feudal clans begin raiding Okinawa and invading. And finally, they, in the late 1800s, 1878-79, they annexed Okinawa. They took it as an official part of Japan and turned it into a colony. And an extremely second-class colony it was. The Japanese replaced the education system. They forbid the natives from speaking their native dialect, which is incomprehensible to Japanese. Most Okinawans did not know Japanese. They were propagandized into believing that they were inferior beings. They're certainly not. They aspired to be pure, true Japanese. And then during the war, they were presented with the glorious opportunity of serving the emperor, which was the ultimate that any of them could hope to achieve, to be chosen to serve in the emperor's army, to be chosen to serve, as many of the young boys were, as messengers. And the girls that I concentrate on, the Princess Lily girls, aspired to serve in the cave hospitals, which they ultimately did.
You know, the term Princess Lily girl sounds so fanciful and wonderful, like something out of a storybook. And in fact, they really lived through hell.
They lived through hell. It's unimaginable what these young girls as young as 12, who were conscripted by the Imperial Japanese Army to, and given virtually no training. And so this group of girls was the cream of Okinawan society, and they were named the Princess Lily Girls after the pins they wore to signify their purity and the fact that they wanted to bring light and illumination to their benighted homeland. So these girls were the cream of Okinawan society and had been forbidden from childhood to so much as speak to a boy. They could be expelled from their elite high school if they exchanged a note with a boy. So here are these very, very sheltered girls, and they're given just the tiniest bit of training. They think they're going to be in some sort of, you know, Red Cross situation, bringing hot tea and, you know, helping soldiers write letters. And instead, they're thrown into these horrific cave hospitals. And although the Japanese army had spent months honeycombing the island with beautiful paved tunnels all the way through for the high command to operate from, including they had telegraph lines and cafeterias, libraries, barracks in there, very well lit and extremely solid construction. These cave hospitals were just dug out of caves. They had dirt floors, stalactites hanging from the ceiling, and that is what they were tossed into, that situation.
My guest is novelist Sarah Bird. Her new book is called Above the East China Sea. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us now at 1-800-933-5372. You can send email to think@kera.org, or you can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can learn to navigate the ever-changing digital landscape with the Social Media and Digital Communication Bootcamp, June 4th through 6th at SMU in Plano. Details and registration at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with novelist Sarah Bird about her new book, Above the East China Sea. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Okay, Sarah, I want to talk a little bit more about Tamiko. You mentioned this sort of propaganda campaign that caused people in Okinawa to really wish to be purely Japanese when that wasn't their heritage. Tamiko grows up with parents who represent two very different cultural forces in Okinawa. Her father, very eager to be Japanese, to placate the Japanese, while her mother remains unapologetically Okinawan.
That's right. And her mother is the one who warns her at the beginning of the bombardment that she gives her a wad of money and tells her, keep this on you. We have poked the sleeping giant, and we're going to lose this war. It's going to be horrible, and you have to be ready, and you have to. And she assigned her the task of looking out for her older sister, and that that is the point at which they go into. And I talked about these cave hospitals, but the duties that these poor girls, these sheltered girls, had to perform, including helping these injured, battle-hardened soldiers with the most intimate bodily functions. You know, these girls who had not exchanged notes with boys are helping amputees urinate and whatnot. So, and they're starving, and they're always thirsty and covered with lice. It's an astonishing story, true story.
And so this first attack, the attack begins, and everything is sort of falling apart. And it sort of reminded me of accounts of the beginning of the Civil War, where there were some people in the South who were like cheering and saying, "This is great!
Yeah.
This is going to
be
our moment of glory." The same thing happens
exactly.
Here. Except for a very small minority who understand, as you said, that the sleeping giant has been awakened.
Exactly. Yeah, there's an Okinawan diaspora because there's so little work on Okinawa. So the men typically either go to sea, they become traders, or they go to places like Hawaii to cut pineapples. So those who had encountered the Americans knew what a mighty country it was, and also how essentially friendly the American people were. But they were silenced and or killed as traitors if they opened their mouth. And the great belief at this point among Okinawans, in spite of looking out and seeing the East China Sea turned black with battleships, was that this was a clever plot on the part of the emperor to lure the Americans into their midst so that they could then be eliminated. And they waited for the emperor to spring his trap, and they waited in vain.
So both of the girls whose stories you tell here have really special relationships with their sisters, and in different ways, but they both feel somehow an obligation to care for their sisters.
Yes, yeah. Tamiko is specifically entrusted by her mother with the job of looking out after her impractical older sister. And she takes that very much to heart. Luz's great emotional connection in life was her sister, Cody, who's been killed in Afghanistan. And both of them are overwhelmed by feelings of loss and bereavement. And this, which I would say is probably the major motivating emotion in the book, is a feeling of loss, which I name one character. His last name is Furusato. He's Luce's crush. Mm. And it's this wonderful word that means homesickness for a place you can never return to. I thought that was very emblematic, both of their experience, of the Okinawans' experiences, who had their villages seized after the war by the American military, and they were forced onto the other side of these vast barbed wire fences so they could see their villages, they could see the places where their ancestors were buried, but they could no longer visit them. And I thought it was also apt for the military brat's experience of, and my own experience of having an experience, having a time in my life with my family that I can never return to.
It made me think a little bit about, you know, people who have gone to college, and you can go back and visit and have a great time.
Yes.
But everybody's different, right? It's not like you can see all your old friends.
Yeah. Exactly. I would say it's even more intense than that, in the sense that you can, you know, you can go back and visit your old school, but none of the teachers will be there.
Right.
The principal will be different, because that, for whatever reasons I've never quite figured out, the military services move everybody randomly around the globe every 2 to 3 years. So the deck is constantly being shuffled. And I feel, you know, it's probably a bit like Jews who return to, you know, the eastern cities, Poland or something, after the war, and all the buildings remain, but everybody they've ever known is gone.
Hmm. Luce's mother, every time they move to a new place, the one thing, you know, the apartment might be different, the house might be different, but she hangs up the same items in approximately the same places.
Yes, except for this move.
Yeah.
This move is different. And as you pointed out, the mother, too, is grieving the loss of her oldest daughter. And there's just been one too many moves, and she's worn out. She's emotionally depleted, and dealing with a troubled daughter, and then having to go to work and prove how tough she is again and again and again in her job with the mostly male soldiers around her.
We haven't really talked about this so far, but Luce has a family connection to Okinawa through her mother, doesn't know a whole lot about that, and hasn't until the moment that we meet her been particularly curious about it.
Right. And that is why Okinawan beliefs are so fundamental to this book, is that she comes to accept that if she doesn't learn who her ancestors are, she will never be able to truly be in contact with her older sister and complete this mission that she's come to accept as her own.
Well, you mentioned her crush, this boy that is Luce's age, who is deeply connected to that culture. And it's interesting, because sometimes we can think, you know, as young people, that something's not cool until we meet someone else that we admire. And then suddenly all of our inhibitions about exploring something fall away. Right.
That's a very good point. In the military culture, and I certainly grew up with it, the most uncool thing you can do is talk about the old days, talk about your hometown, talk about the way it was before. The military, particularly Air Force, I mean, I assume the rest of the services are like this. They're very, very future-oriented. They're very, very focused on the mission, get the mission done. And homesickness just does not factor in. And grieving for the place you lost and the people you left behind, that also does not factor in. So it's just very uncool. That's sort of the most American way you can be, in that you don't place a lot of emphasis on who your quote-unquote people were. Your people are this new family you've made in the military, and that's what the culture is all about.
I realize I'm asking you to generalize here, but what are the expectations in a military family for how the children of that family will react then every time they're told that it's time to pack up and move again?
This is interesting, because we were told this time and time again, and there was no reaction. The expectation was there would be no reaction. And
yeah.
I cannot remember ever saying, but I don't want to leave. I finally have a friend here. I love it here. I'm happy here. Don't make me this. It was unthinkable. So I don't know how much different it is now, but certainly for me, that was just not part of the equation. That was irrelevant.
So at the beginning of the story, we know that Tamiko takes her own life. Luce is thinking about taking her own life.
She is. She's just like her mother. She's had one too many moves and one too many experiences of having to fit in yet again with what she calls quasis. Mm. And these are the quasi-friend-esque beings that she has to ingratiate herself with and get to know almost, but not quite, get to know before new orders come. And they have to leave one more time. And she's just worn out, you know, on the heels of her sister's death. She does not have the emotional resources to do that anymore. And so know, here she is, a 17-year-old girl with no support, essentially, and she finds her comfort in this group of kids called the Smokin' Owens, which are composed of, you know, the stoner kids and the Hafus, the you know, the name that explains itself. They're half Okinawan, half American, or one quarter, or one, you know, a mix of mm-hmm. everything, as Lou says, your basic caramel person. But also, she points out, no one in her group is racist, but they're all rankist. We're not racist, we're rankist. And so she's keenly aware of the rank of all her parents, the parents of her friends, but could care less about their race.
Yeah, that was another really interesting phenomenon that I had not heard of before, that, like, there's no question that everybody knows what your military parent or parents do, and that's how you get ranked socially.
Not as much as it used to be. Certainly when I was growing up, it was very not cool for officers' kids to hang out with enlisted, because it was not the ideal. It was not what they aspired to. And, you know, you lived in different neighborhoods. There's mm-hmm. officers' housing, there's enlisted housing, and barracks for the GIs. So you were separated that way, and you just very quickly came to know. I sort of never developed that radar particularly well, you know, part of my obliviousness, but I certainly observed it among my friends and observe it to this day.
And of course, there's also the choice to be made as to whether you are going to embrace the values of your parents and what they have chosen to devote mm-hmm. their lives to, or whether you are going to look at that like it's the worst, dumbest possible thing you could do.
and it's true. Military kids that I've known in later life really seem to split into two very distinct camps. And they're the rebels who hate any kind of authority, just hate it. And then those who joined the service that they grew up in. And are very, very happy. They're very comfortable and, you know, raise kids who then join the service. Or they find some very, very structured environment, a very structured law firm or some kind of system like that. And it feels comfortable to them. But as I say, there are massive numbers of war protesters came from the ranks of military kids.
And we come to learn that Luce's mother needs this structure. And we, you know, Luce has just found it sort of distasteful all this time. And we won't say exactly how this process happens, but she ultimately recognizes that her mother needed, you know, an organization that makes you roll your socks in a certain way and fold your laundry in a certain way and get up at exactly the same time every day.
Yeah, I really had to do a lot of research to kind of update myself about the military today and an incredible resource for all the personal online video diaries that many recruits put up about their experiences of going through basic training and specialized training. And one of the things I got there was this rolling your socks up into a little ball. And you know, during inspection, they'd have their few drawers opened up and everything had to be ship shape, perfectly tidy. And yes, so that a lot of structure there, and it was a shock to Luce to really find out and accept that her sister needed the same thing for her own reasons.
Talk about your decision not to return to Okinawa. You did tons of research, but you deliberately decided not to go back there.
I did, you know, for two reasons. The most obvious is that the research I needed to do was on young Okinawans, young military kids on Okinawa, and I know if I'd shown up in all my old lady glory, I would have gotten nothing out of them. It would have been like when I was researching rodeos for my novel Virgin of the Rodeo, and I stupidly attempted to interview cowboys, and what I got back was, yes, ma'am, no, ma'am, spick show, yes, ma'am, no, ma'am, I guess I'm just crazy, ma'am. And I knew that would happen. You know, they just go into their little shells, but another great gift of the internet right there on YouTube is an entire channel called Planet Oki devoted to Smokin' Owens. So the wonderful thing about that was it's mostly centered around hip-hop music. Mm-hmm. So it's very edgy culture of young people. And all, I think virtually all the videos were done at night, and most of the kids are toasted. Mm-hmm. So they're speaking very freely. And that was fantastic. It was just what I needed. The other reason I did not want to go back to Okinawa, aside from the fact that it's incredibly expensive and a very, very long plane flight, mm-hmm. is that it was a golden period in my family's life. Everyone in my family, we were very close, and family was intact. We were all young and healthy and having this grand adventure together. And I sort of wanted to keep that memory pristine and golden, preserved in amber forever.
Did you, were you tempted to like write back to any of these Smokinawans in the comments of their videos? Like, oh, sweetheart, you really need to quit that. I mean, did like your maternal instincts emerge?
That's funny. That never crossed my mind.
Really?
I'm looking and going, these young people are having a great time. They are making the absolute most. Look at they're making music. They're starting a whole new kind of music, and they're out experiencing the culture. And I thought they were just tremendous fun, and you know, doing what you're supposed to do at that age.
Do you find now that military kids are more encouraged to sort of venture out and engage? Because I was not a military child myself, but mm-hmm. I went to college with some who had been. And they really said it wasn't like necessarily, it wasn't forbidden, but they weren't encouraged to go blend with the locals and soak up culture.
The locals. I cannot speak for today's military. I, you know, from my online perusing, it's the same, you know, that I see comments about, you know, there are people who never leave the base and those who get out, you mm-hmm. know, and join the Smokinawans and have a little bit of life outside the base. But they're definitely, in my time, there were definitely, you could easily go over there and never, and that's true now. Mm. They're the most quintessentially American place on earth is the overseas military base. And now they have Burger King and pizza places and Dunkin' Donuts, and you can go and never leave.
What a missed opportunity, so though.
Absolutely. Tragic.
We're speaking with novelist Sarah Bird about her new book, Above the East China Sea. We'll come back in a couple of minutes. If you want to join the conversation, call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Summer registration is now open with courses in art, history, literature, communication, piano, and Portuguese. Registration online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with novelist Sarah Bird about her new book, Above the East China Sea. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So, Sarah, continuing with this idea that mm-hmm. Really Okinawans have not been given a great deal of control over their own fate for some time now, you had an op-ed piece recently in the New York Times talking about this and reminding Americans of the fact that Okinawans have asked multiple times, for multiple reasons, to remove a significant portion of the U.S. military presence in Japan from Okinawa.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about the circumstances that have caused them to feel like this is really an untenable situation?
Right. Well, in Okinawa, the day in September 1951, the day that the treaty accord was signed between the U.S. and Japan is known in Okinawa as the Day of Shame, because at that point, in collaboration between Washington and Tokyo, essentially, the Pentagon got the Ryukyu Islands a sort of party favor and were allowed to station most of the troops that Japan was going to host on Okinawa, the Ryukyu Islands. And they took up one-fifth of prime real estate, this very, very scarce farmland on this tiny island. It's 460-some square miles, about the size of Los Angeles. And the U.S. military continues to occupy almost one-fifth of that, which is staggering to me to think of, you know, how would any of us feel if foreign troops had occupied one-fifth of our home state since the end of World War II? And there's been lots of environmental degradation. There's the economy has been stalled because the sorts of jobs available are, you know, busboys and guards and whatnot. They're not economy-building jobs. And crime, lots of crime, which was, until the island reverted to Japan in 1972, was completely handled within the American court system. In 1972, the island reverted to Japan and once again became a prefecture of Japan. And at that point, the Okinawans felt doubly betrayed because the whole idea of reversion was to get some of the military, U.S. military presence off of Okinawa, and that did not happen. Once again, because of a collaboration between Tokyo and Washington.
Right, and obviously for those who live on the Japanese mainland, why not put everything in this sort of distant island area that is not that won't be in the way of people who are living in the rest of Japan?
Right, and Okinawa is far and away the tiniest prefecture in Japan, and they have very little political power within the system. So there, the wishes of the Okinawan people are overridden again and again and again. And there were island-wide protests after the 1995 rape of a 12-year-old schoolgirl by three American servicemen. And at that point, some concessions were made mostly on paper, and there's been very, very little fulfillment of promises to the Okinawan people.
Sexual assault features in this book as well in ways that we won't talk about directly for people who want to read the story, but it is brutal and it is awful, and it you really hit us with it very hard. And I wonder about whether those accounts were based on things that you read that happened to actual people, or whether you had to sort of take dramatic license. How did that those scenes
come to your mind?
Oh, no.
There's many, many, many accounts of rape of Native women by both Japanese and American soldiers. We know a great deal more about the rape by Japanese soldiers than we do by American soldiers, but there are lots and lots of accounts. There's a very famous story of villagers finally, after receiving no justice after the war, they took matters into their own hand and hunted down these predators, these sexual predators who were invading their village every night to assault the young women there. So, this is very well documented. And there were lots of pregnancies, most of them terminated.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Suzanne in Denton. Hello, Suzanne.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to comment that I was a military brat as well. My father was in the Air Force, and we lived on Okinawa.
Hey, sister.
we lived on Okinawa from 1959 to 1961 when I was in junior high school. And I stood on Suicide Cliff.
Oh, gosh. It's just such an idyllic place. It's a little island paradise.
It was. And we lived in the village of Kadena for about a year before we moved on to the base. And we all loved it, and it was very safe. And my girlfriend and I, when we were 12, would go off base to the village, Koza, and shop and come back. And I thought it was just a magical time for all of us to live there.
It was for me, too. I mean, it's, as they say in the service, great duty. And it's certainly, for the Pentagon, very cheap duty, since our bases there are completely underwritten by the Japanese taxpayers. So all the, you know, the household help that service members receive and whatnot, part of their salaries are paid for by the Japanese government and these great facilities and whatnot. So that's part of the equation.
Another thing that Okinawans have objected to with regard to the vast U.S. military presence there is they feel like they're a target in a way that they never would be right. if they didn't have
right.
military.
You have to remember that this is a country that the Japanese disarmed over 100 years ago. There have been no weapons on Okinawa for well over 100 years. And this is the place where karate was invented because they had no way of defending themselves. And that makes it, you know, irony doesn't even begin to cover it. Just so tragic that such a peace-loving people have again and again been martyrs to geography because of their very vital placement on the East China Sea, which is once again coming into intense focus in the headlines as China and Japan rattle swords about this resource-rich area at the very, very tip of the Ryukyu Islands.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Tony in Fort Worth. Hi, Tony.
Hi. I really enjoyed the program.
I
spent 18 months in Okinawa in the Air Force, enlisted man in 1955 and 56. I spent most of my time on Kumijima, west of Naha, and in Okino Irabushima, northeast of the main island, and then the rest of my time at Naha Air Base, which is probably deactivated now.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time I was over there, I hadn't heard this story, but on reading up about the islands and the war later on, I've read that the native language is actually called Luchuan, which comes from a Chinese word, Luchu. And the reason for that was that the Japanese could not pronounce the L very well, so they changed that to Ryukyuan. Does Sarah have any information on that?
No, that's correct. That's absolutely correct. Much of the Okinawan language was Japanized when they took over. But you certainly must have had an idyllic experience being there at the time and place you were.
Does it feel strange for you now to be in a position where you're advocating for the U.S. to move, if not eliminate, its military bases in that part of the world, even though you were there and had a wonderful experience?
Yes. That there's a little bit of a conflict feeling like, oh, well, I had such a great time and I don't want you to have it. But the other reality is that the military just can no longer afford the kind of family-friendly service it once was because it's colossally expensive. Dependents are colossally expensive. So whatever my feelings about it, that is coming to an end more and more around the world as we go to what they like to think of as this nimble fleet fighting force. And, you know, there are now 700 overseas military bases, very few of them are the kind that I experience. They're in places nobody has heard of. The American people have no idea they exist. And so,
Was it, were you able to easily sort of transition into writing about this? It's not magical realism, but you really do kind of enter the spiritual realm with some of these characters, and you're sort of describing their thought process after they have died. And really a culture and a set of ideas that I have to imagine don't reflect what you were raised with, but that you find very compelling.
No, that was hard. That was finding the key to that situation, knowing I did not want to do a ghost story. I did not want to do magic realism. I did not want to do woo-woo. Although I was very formed by 100 years of solitude, which most writers of my generation are. But I read a book by an African author, Ben Okwi, called The Famished Road. And that, combined with the novels of John Burdett, who writes about a Buddhist detective in Thailand, were very helpful to me in that they accepted these different cultural beliefs and just took them as givens and tried not to make too much of them. But the challenge for me was getting American readers to enter into a world so different from our own and ruled by beliefs so different from our own.
I loved it because I think it causes you to realize that whatever we may believe might seem foreign in some parts of the world. Mm-hmm. The moment you think, well, isn't this exotic? You have to think, well, isn't what I believe pretty exotic for someone else?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I've had a couple of people comment, oh, I don't really like, you know, spiritual kinds of things or, you know, otherworldly kinds of things. And like, well, it really isn't. These are as down to earth and as practical as you can imagine in the way that, let's say, you know, we guide our lives by the golden rule. It's the same sort of thing, you know, and why do we? Because maybe heaven, you know, we're kind of thinking about that. So it is exactly as you say, it's a complete equivalent.
Is it awful that I spent the whole novel wishing that somehow I was wrong and misunderstood that Tamiko had actually killed herself?
I love that you did. That's wonderful. That's really, really wonderful. I know. I didn't know when I started the novel how it was going to end up. But, oh, God, I wanted to be happy for Tamiko. I love that character so much. And I can pick the book up now and read the first page and start crying because, God, she goes through so much.
We should let people know. It's funny because I read the book and then I have subsequently read some reviews of the book. And there are people who say there's no humor. It's very dark. It certainly deals with very dark subject matter. But first of all, there is, I think, Luce's take on life is often very wry and funny. And then there are moments of lightness and of sort of, you know, when suddenly a character comes to an understanding she didn't have before, to me, that's really transformative and not so dark at all.
I think it's, you know, it's the material. It's mm-hmm. very, the material is very intense. And my publisher has gone to great lengths to stress that for me, it's a stunning departure because mm-hmm. I'm known for writing novels people consider comic and they're worried that readers
yeah.
are going to get this one and then they will depart stunned when they find out it's not a laugh riot.
Right,
this
right.
one is not a laugh riot, but it's something more important than that.
Hmm. And when you finish with a work like this, are you wishing for more or does it always feel resolved in your sort of in your heart and in your brain?
This book was very, very emotional for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel very passionate about the issues behind it and very committed to Americans learning more about this situation and helping give voice to people who have not had enough of a voice, although we have been so critical in their lives and they and their island have been so important in our lives and grow more important all the time.
Sarah Bird's new novel is called Above the East China Sea. Sarah, it is always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Chris. I loved it.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Katie Daniel. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.